Chapter 15, Magnificent Mammals, The Wanderer's Ignominious Destruction by Running Aground off Cuttyhunk in 1924, all but ended New Bedford's role in this story. The Yankee Bark, with its canvas sails and wooden whaleboats, was long since eclipsed by the faster-moving, propeller-driven craft. Whaling in the 20th century is a depressing story of gross population decimation. An immense global commercial enterprise utilized new and ever-evolving technology to catch and kill whales in methods and quantities that dwarfed the pursuit of the 19th century Yankee whalers. More whales were caught in just three seasons in the mid-20th century, 1963 to 65, than in the entire era that New Bedford whalers went to sea. In the age of sail, few whalers ventured into the deep Antarctic, as oarsmen could not catch up with the fast blue, minke, or fin whales. Even if the whales were caught, their specific gravity was such that they sank when killed. Therefore, these populations remained relatively unscathed. However, this was not the case a century later, when steam-powered, propeller-driven catcher boats were able to chase and shoot explosive harpoons at these whales, and then inject air as needed to ensure that all whales killed would stay afloat before being processed. Catcher boats would bring the whales to shore-based factories for processing, but beginning in 1907, they could bring their kill to floating factory ships. Later, the spotter planes ensured total dominance of air and sea, as it directed fleets with lethal efficiency. The huge scale of these operations and the profits generated led to nearly 2.9 million large whales being killed between 1900 and 1999. In contrast to whaling a generation earlier, this type of industrial whaling was arguably more brutal. It was certainly less personal, less dangerous, and shorter in terms of voyage duration than hand whaling in the age of sail. In short, long gone was any romantic sense of exotic adventure and courageous pursuit. Alarmed by the approaching catastrophe, an increasing awareness in many countries led to action necessary to prevent total species extinction. Commercial whaling attracted ships and crews from several, mostly European, countries. After the two world wars, the populations of lands ravaged by warfare needed to be fed, and whale meat was plentiful. General Douglas MacArthur, who oversaw the management of Japan after World War II, encouraged its fishermen to develop their modern whale fishery, a radically different enterprise from the shore-based whaling heritage of Japan dating back hundreds of years. Norway, England, Japan, and the USSR had whaling operations in both hemispheres. In the north, Canada, China, Denmark, Iceland, Korea, Portugal, Spain, France, the Netherlands, and the United States all sent ships out to hunt whales. South of the equator, Argentina, Australia, Brazil, Chile, New Zealand, Panama, Peru, and South Africa had their fleets out in search of whales. These ships set out to convert whales into a far greater variety of products than simply lubricating or burning oils. Now, blubber was turned into margarine, shoe polish, soap, cooking oil, and glycerin-based explosives, as well as lubricating oils. Coarse Rorqual baleen was made into brushes and combs. Sperm whale oil continued to be very popular as lubricating oil and was added to transmission and brake fluid, too. Hydrogenated sperm oil was used in cosmetics, detergents, rust-proofing compounds, photographic glazes, and leather softeners. Ambergris from sperm whales was used in perfumes. Skeletal bone was turned into fertilizers and fish meal. Tendons would become tennis racket strings. Muscle would become steak for human consumption. And the collagen in whale flukes was used in glue production. Increasing awareness that action needed to be taken, popular opinion and political will coalesced. In 1946, the International Convention for the Regulation of Whaling devised a stringent management system for the international whaling industry. This agreement served to monitor whaling activities so that the industry could sustain itself. In the U.S., the passing of the Marine Mammal Protection Act in 1972 and the Endangered Species Act in 1973 brought an end to the U.S. market for whale products. the voluntary moratorium ratified by a majority of International Whaling Commission members in 1982 ended most global commercial whaling. Only Norway and Iceland continue to hunt for commercial purposes, while Japan does so under the guise of scientific research, as allowed by Article 7 in the International Convention for the Regulation of Whaling. Over the past several decades, global environmental issues have gained ascendancy by calling into question many of humanity's excessive abuses of natural resources. Recent popular culture, from literature to art, and from film to television, is filled with a rekindled fascination with and respect for whales. Now, perhaps more than ever before, the predicament of the whale seems to have reawakened some of the human veneration of earlier periods and acted as a catalyst for increased environmental activism. 90 species of whales, dolphins, and porpoises, collectively known as cetaceans, are the subject of countless hours of research performed annually around the globe. Some researchers use innovative methods and equipment and often work in unpredictable and dangerous conditions. Others work in necropsy, animal autopsy research, in labs, or pore through historical records searching for relevant data. Their collaborative work has informed and enhanced whale conservation efforts by helping shape laws and treaties established to protect whales. The story of human interactions with whales would be incomplete without discussing today's scientific work and the changes made in fishing practices to protect cetaceans. Whales today continue to face challenges that are all the more perilous due to their diminished populations. There is the aforementioned continuation of commercial whaling, but less known and arguably more destructive are ship strikes and entanglement from fishing gear. Some whales, such as the North Atlantic right whale, have evolved in such a way that their habits, migratory patterns, and biology put them in direct conflict with modern commercial shipping traffic and fishing practices. There are approximately 500 individuals remaining of this gentle, slow-moving, surface-feeding species. They are in great danger unless regulations continue to evolve to protect them. This requires ongoing cooperation among scientists, commercial shippers, and fishermen to find viable solutions that benefit both the whales and the economy. According to the Provincetown Center for Coastal Studies, over 50% of known right whale mortalities have been attributed to either entanglements or ship strikes. Two of the whales in the museum's mammal skeleton collection died as a result of ship strikes. The skeletons have become excellent teaching tools to inform the public about conservation and the threats that whales face today. Unlike the pelagic deep-water sperm whale, North Atlantic right whales feed at or near the surface. They sift tiny zooplankton through the baleen plates in their enormous mouths, rarely swim faster than 2 to 3 knots, and tend to stay within 50 miles, 80 kilometers, of the shore along the eastern coast of the United States. Unfortunately, freighters go 25 to 30 knots, and shipping lanes run through many of the most populated areas and migratory tracts of those whales. Commercial freighters are an important part of the global commerce and have to coexist with the whales. New regulations slow commercial shipping speeds to 10 knots in certain areas at specified times of the year to coincide with whale migrations. This has already resulted in some improvement, but increasing the range of these restrictions to include more of the whales' critical habitats is vital for continued protection of this species. In both the United States and Canada, a shift of major traffic lanes to areas outside the greatest density of North Atlantic right whale population has diminished the likelihood of ship strikes by at least 75%. Fishing gear entanglement threats to whales have been addressed with a variety of restrictions beginning in 1997. In most coastal areas, lobster pots are typically attached to one another with floating lines. These are a danger to whales because the whales could swim into these lines and get them tangled around flippers and flukes, or get the lines caught in their mouths while they are feeding. Imagine trying to swim thousands of miles while dragging hundreds of pounds of line and gear, and the immense pain of increasing constriction as the lines tighten over time. Massachusetts, however, instituted a seasonal ban of floating lines in 1997 in right whale critical habitats. Beginning in 2004, Massachusetts expanded this ban on floating lines to include all state waters. Breakaway buoys at the surface and breakaway links and swivels along the trawls are also used to lessen these threats. Grant funds have been used to buy the floating lines from lobstermen and help them purchase sinking lines in order to minimize impacts on and costs to lobster fisheries. Research continues into how to minimize the possibility of entanglement with vertical lines used in fixed gear fisheries. In fact, new rules regarding sinking lines, number of traps per trawl, number of vertical lines in the water, and gear markings went into effect in the Northeast in June 2015. The museum plays an integral role in modern conservation as a repository of historical data on whales and whaling and of information regarding issues facing whales today. The recent acquisition of the William A. Watkins Collection of Marine Mammal Sound Recordings and Data, donated by the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, deepens and strengthens our research potential. It further distinguishes the museum as a research center for whale conservation. As a whole, the Watkins Collection tells the story of marine bioacoustics from the 1940s through the 1990s. These recordings, made by Watkins and William Chaville, initiated a valuable field of research that has already proven useful for the U.S. military, whale conservation researchers and scholars, and others interested in whales. Chapter 15, Profiles of William E. Chaville and William A. Watkins. William E. Chaville, 1906 to 1994, founded the field of marine mammal bioacoustics just after World War II. When William A. Watkins, 1926 to 2004, joined him at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in 1958, they began a 40-year collaboration that changed the face of marine mammal science. During his four decades at Woods Hole, Watkins developed many of the research tools that remain at the center of marine mammal bioacoustics: whale tags, underwater playback experiments, methods to locate marine mammal sounds underwater, and methods to identify and follow individual animals. Bill Watkins built the first tape recorder capable of recording marine mammals at sea, enabling a sudden blossoming of field studies. His first publication at Woods Hole was a phonograph recording of marine mammal sounds called Whale and Porpoise Voices, published by Chaville and Watkins in 1962. Watkins responded to the problem of how to record the animal sounds from small vessels by building a portable tape recorder. He went on to develop most of the scientific tools that form the basis of the bioacoustics field. Through his long career, Watkins pursued research interest in acoustic pattern recognition systems, underwater acoustic behavior of marine animals, seasonal distribution and activities of cetaceans, location and tracking systems, acoustic, radio, and satellite, database organization for marine animal data, cetacean vocal identity, acoustic and sonar studies of underwater animal activity and linguistics. While most of his peers presented sounds only in figures, Watkins published actual acoustic data. During the last decade of his life, he developed a digital database with over 20,000 calls for more than 70 species of marine mammals. Chapter 15, Profile, Freeing an Injured Whale. Disentangling whales from fishing lines and nets is a dangerous undertaking. The animals experience the stress of being entangled and are likely in intense pain. In these situations, they often react negatively to being approached by any type of boat, even if it's carrying a well-trained disentanglement team. Some species, such as the North Atlantic right whale, seem to always make great efforts to avoid rescue vessels. These evasive measures can be dangerous. The impact of the flailing tail of a 40-ton animal could be deadly. Sedation dart technology had been developed in the early 2000s and first put into action in 2009. The canister of the sedation dart holds a carefully measured mix of sedatives, while the leading edge of the needle penetrates the skin, blubber, and muscle surface to deliver the mixture. It enables a crew to get close enough to remove the fishing gear wrapped around the head, mouth, and flippers of the whale. The National Marine Fisheries Service placed the carcass in the care of the Whaling Museum. Kobo was submerged in cages and cleaned by marine organisms in New Bedford Harbor. The oil was not completely extracted, and the skeleton is expected to leak oil into a flask underneath the skeleton for another 50 years. The bones of living whales, which are heavily saturated with oil, hold up to a third of the whale's total oil content. Quasimodo, the humpback whale. Quasimodo was a 37-foot male humpback whale that was found dead on the island known as No Man's Land off the southern coast of Martha's Vineyard. He died in 1932, and his skeleton has been in the museum since 1936. Quasimodo was towed ashore in Westport, Massachusetts, stripped and buried in the sand at Horseneck Beach as a way to clean the bones. His skeleton has been moved three times as the layout of the museum changed. He originally hung next to the Lagoda in the Bourne Building, with the final move into the Jacobs Family Gallery in 2000. Because they are slow swimmers, humpback whales were an easy target for whalers. Their populations have recovered slowly since they received protection in 1966 and again in 1985. Humpbacks are the most acrobatic whales and are commonly seen on local whale watch trips. Their antics include breaching, lobtailing, spy hopping, and flipper waving. Raina, the right whale. Raina was a 49-foot, 14.9-meter, 15-year-old female North Atlantic right whale. With a population of only about 500 individuals, the right whale is the most endangered of all whales. Tragically, Raina was 10 months pregnant with her first calf when she was accidentally struck by a ship off the coast of Virginia in 2005. The fetus appears to have been a female, so this ship strike had an even greater effect on the population. Her necropsy was performed along North Carolina's Outer Banks, and her bones were moved to New Bedford, where microbes from horse and elephant manure from New Bedford's Buttonwood Park Zoo clean them. The position and angle of the fetus are a best guess as to how she existed inside the mother. This heart-wrenching display is the only one of its kind in the world. There are three distinct right whale species in our global ocean. All three right whale species have raised patches of skin called callosities. Each whale's callosity pattern is unique to that whale and is used to identify individuals as are DNA samples taken by scientists. Raina was well known to scientists who tracked her throughout her life. The DNA records, compared with data from other right whales, indicate that Raina had one older sibling and three younger siblings. The sperm whale. This 48-foot-long juvenile male sperm whale was discovered stranded on Nantucket Island south of Great Point Lighthouse on June 7, 2002. Information from the necropsy report suggests that he died on the beach. Moving a dead whale is not an easy proposition. The body was towed for 9 hours behind a tugboat to a shipyard in Fairhaven, Massachusetts, and then loaded onto a long flatbed truck and driven to New Bedford's landfill. Over the next few days, a necropsy and flensing, removal of soft tissue, were performed. During the flensing process, there was concern over how the whale had died and whether his widespread joint disease was contagious. Test results proved negative, and the whale was put to rest in a bed of manure for a few months to clean the soft tissue and leach oil from the bones. They were laid out to whiten or cure in the sun, and then were brought into the museum for articulation in 2005. The sperm whale is the largest of the toothed whales. They are among the deepest diving cetaceans and are found in all the oceans of the world. They have been tracked to depths of over 7,000 feet. One sperm whale lost its jaw to a transatlantic cable resting 3,756 feet down on the ocean bottom. Although sperm whales were one of the most heavily exploited of all the world's whales because of the superior characteristics of the spermaceti oil, they are still relatively abundant. Chapter 15, Profile, Why Yankee Whalers Never Modernized. American whaling agents, particularly those in New Bedford, sought safer investments for their profits in the post-war years of the 1860s, expanding cotton, textile, and other manufacturing facilities instead of modernizing their aging whaling fleet. There was no will to continue whaling. Shipbuilding was expensive. Infrastructure was antiquated. The products of whaling were one-dimensional.
Coming up, 3, 2, 1.
While one could burn whale and sperm oil, it was not much good as an energy source, and petroleum lent itself to highly versatile refinement, creating a combustible liquid that could drive engines. American whaling contributed little or nothing to new, versatile whale products. Americans did not eat whale meat, could not catch the fast rorquals, and lacked expertise in developing improvements to their raw materials.
3, 2, 1.
However, the Transcontinental Railroad opened gigantic industrial manufacturing, mining, and natural resources exploitation, opportunities that American investors seized and developed greedily. This evolved into the American Gilded Age, when monopoly trusts secured control of virtually everything from real estate to coal to copper ingots. America turned her back on the sea, and American investors, New Bedford businessmen included, concentrated on developing land-based natural resources using masses of immigrant laborers. Geography also contributed to American isolation.
3, 2, 1.
The frontier was won, and the railroad and Great Lakes ensured that markets for American products were built in. Sag Harbor whaleman Thomas Welcome Royce and New York explosives expert Gustavus Adolphus Liliendahl experimented with rocket harpoons and other technology, first in the Atlantic and later in California. Other entrepreneurial whalers, Scots-Canadians James Dawson and Abel Douglas, set out to hunt rorquals on the coast of British Columbia using only bomb lances and towboats.
3, 2, 1.
American shipbuilding technology, so long dependent upon plentiful, almost inexhaustible timber supplies, was made obsolete by European iron-hulled, steam-driven ships.
3, 2, 1.
These West Coast endeavors never fully developed due to a lack of investors until the early 20th century, when Norwegian technology was purchased and put to work. In the meantime, Norwegians seeking new economic opportunities turned to their traditional skills of shipbuilding and seafaring. Sven Foyn invented a number of technological innovations that allowed narwhals to be hunted efficiently, and these evolved into specialized shipbuilding and ordnance manufacturing. So successful were these combined technologies that they quickly spread around the industrialized world. American shipbuilding technology, so long dependent upon plentiful, almost inexhaustible